You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In this episode, we're bringing the second of two highlights from the recent One Crown Office Row seminar, Scope of Duty and Causation, Chester and Afshar Revisited. We now hear from Dominic Ruck-Keane about the effects of this case.
I think the first thing to say is that there have been a large number of cases which are discussed and considered at Chester since it was held. And there are well over 50 citations on Westlaw, and don't worry, I'm not going to take you blow by blow through each one of them. In the last year, there's been three Court of Appeal cases where this has been considered. I've listed there what have sort of been the key Court of Appeal cases on this. There's also Michael John as well. But I think one to note is that also Samco, because that case was not actually considered in Chester, and as we'll go on to see, has actually become quite an important case to be considered alongside Chester. It's also worth noting that in Montgomery, which obviously opened the door to consent cases as we now know it, Chester was not considered. It was cited briefly, but not then considered. What I think I'd just like to do for the remainder of this bit of the talk is to just try to take you through some of the themes of how the cases have approached Chester. The first is how the ratio has been interpreted, or perhaps reinterpreted. The second is avoiding using Chester where possible by finding possibly some slightly interesting definitions of the but-for principle of causation. Then, really, this has been with the bulk of cases, which is trying to confine Chester and put the genie back in the box through a variety of different ways. And then, lastly, where there's been explicit judicial criticism of Chester. And then I'll attempt at the end to try to give a summary of where I think we currently are at in terms of the law. So really, first of all, in terms of how the court said, well, what does Chester actually say? Shaw against Kovac said, simple, it's a decision on causation. But as we'll go on to see, a lot of the other cases have slightly fudged it. Is it actually about causation? Is it about scope of duty? Or is it, in fact, a specific decision just about a particular kind of consent case? Correa, a bit more straightforward. I think that's a sort of fair summary, really, of the ratio. But, you know, it is negligent failure, particular risk, an intimate connection to the duty of warn. Then the injury is to be regarded as caused, and being regarded is that sort of critical policy-heavy word. And then Deuce against Worcestershire, it was a case where the claimant had argued that if she had been given an appropriate warning, she wouldn't have had surgery on the day in question. The judge at first instance found, as a matter of fact, that even if there had been an appropriate warning, she would have proceeded with the operation on that day. Lord Justice Hambledon analysed Chester as being about causation, saying that the injury in Chester was a result of the breach of duty because the operation would not have taken place when it did. The risk of injury was very small, so unlikely to have occurred if the operation had been carried out on a subsequent occasion because the percentage chance was so much less than 50%. So the Court of Appeal and Deuce held that Chester did not establish a freestanding test, but rather set out the circumstances which justified the normal approach to causation being modified. And that modification is to treat a but-for cause that's not an effective cause in law as a sufficient cause in the unusual circumstances of the case, which again rather opens up more questions than actually answers. But Deuce held that the majority decision in Chester does not negate the requirement for a claimant to demonstrate a but-for causative effect of the breach of duty, as that requirement was interpreted by the majority, and specifically that the operation would not have taken place when it did. And similarly, Lord Justice Leggett held as essential to the decision in Chester that if properly warned, the claimant would not have had the operation on the day she did. However, I would argue that the focus in Chester, as you've heard from John, is not actually on the delay. It's about whether the injury was within scope of duty. So next theme really is trying to avoid relying on Chester. And here in Crossman against St George's, there was a nerve root injury following surgery. It was accepted that the risks had been appropriately explained, but the surgeon's plan had been for conservative treatment for 3 months, then review the patient to surgery. But instead, she actually just had surgery without that pause. The claimant said, well, without that negligence, I wouldn't have had the operation on the day I did, so I'm entitled to compensation either on conventional but-for causation or through Chester. And the claimant's expert said, well, there are a number of little factors which would have made a different operation had it been done 3 months earlier. For example, the claimant's position on the table and other various, very specific, saying, well, you're never going to repeat that precise circumstance of the operation if you did it on a different day. And the judge said, well, those factors are constant inherent variables in the risk. It's basically saying the same thing never happens again in precisely the same way. For example, if you bake a cake or take a penalty shot at goal, the result won't be precisely the same every time. The fact that things went wrong this time is not a predictor of things going wrong on any other occasion. Indeed, because the risks are so low, the risks were less than 2%, it almost certainly would not go wrong on a different occasion. And so therefore, he said, well, the risk is not so high, because it's not over 50%, that if you'd done the operation on a different day, then the risk would happen. So therefore, Mr. Crossman was unlucky. Had he had the operation on a different occasion, on the balance of probabilities, the operation would have been successful. So the claimant succeeded on conventional but-for principles. He therefore said, I don't need to go near Chester. I would note that I think that's a very odd application of the balance of probabilities to say, well, it's a 2% chance, so therefore it's not going to happen if it's done on a different day. But other ways that Chester has been applied and other cases have Crossman's come in for quite a lot of criticism. And one of the key themes really for confining Chester has been saying, well, there is actually no new duty created by it. Shaw against Kovac held that notwithstanding Chester, if there's a failure to give proper advice, then that does not create a new cause of action, for example, for a wrongful invasion of someone's personal autonomy. There was no issue of causation in Shaw. It was accepted that the deceased never would have had the operation if they'd been properly informed. So therefore, you establish on the balance of probabilities, proper advice, no operation at all, not at a different point, just never. And Deuce, and then more recently, Diamond against Royal Devon, again, reinforced there is no freestanding right to be given all the information in order to give informed consent, and therefore there is no cause of action merely for a failure to give informed consent. You have to prove damage. Another way that Chester's been confined is by saying, well, it's about scope of duty, it's not about causation. And the key case here really has been Samco, and then more recently Pomfrey's re-emphasised this. And it's worth noting that Samco, as I said earlier, wasn't cited or considered in Chester. And Lord Hoffman in Samco gave the leading judgment and said, rules which make the wrongdoer liable for all the consequences of his wrongful conduct are exceptional and need to be justified by some special policy. Normally, the law limits liabilities to those consequences which are attributable to that which made the act wrongful. The general principle is that a person under a duty to take reasonable care to provide information on which someone else will decide upon a course of action is, if negligent, not generally regarded as responsible for all the consequences of that course of action. He's responsible only for the consequences of that information being wrong. A duty of care which imposes on the informant responsibility for losses which would have occurred, even if the information which he gave had been correct, is not, in my view, fair and reasonable between the parties. I'll just stop there to say exactly why this case is not cited in Chester is hard to see now, because clearly we are talking about giving information when doctors are giving advice about potential options. Lord Hoffman used the example of the mountaineer about to undertake a difficult climb, concerned about the fitness of his knee. He goes to a doctor who makes a superficial and negligent examination and pronounces the knee fit. The climber goes on the expedition, which he would not have gone on had he been told about the true state of his knee. He has an injury, which is an entirely foreseeable consequence of mountaineering, but has nothing to do with his knee. And Lord Hoffman said, well, on the usual principle, the doctor's not liable. The injury has not been caused by the doctor's bad advice, because it would have occurred even if the advice had been correct. and imposing liability would offend common sense because there would not be sufficient causal connection with the subject matter of the duty. The doctor was asked for information only on one of the considerations which might affect the safety of the mountaineer on the expedition. There is no reason in policy to transfer the risk onto the doctor of all the foreseeable consequences of the expedition. Also in Kahn, which against Meadows were a recent case, the claimant was given negligent advice about the risk of giving birth to a child with haemophilia. She subsequently gave birth to a child with that condition. A defendant accepted that but for negligent advice, she would have terminated the pregnancy and the child would not have been born. The child, however, was subsequently diagnosed with autism, and the issue was whether the mother could recover for the costs of bringing up a child with haemophilia and autism, or whether the defendant was only liable about the cost in relation to haemophilia. In the High Court, it was held that this was much closer to Chester and Ashfar as opposed to the mountaineer's knee in Samco, because the risk of autism was an inevitable risk of any pregnancy, but it couldn't be said it probably would have materialised in another pregnancy. The focus of the defendant's duty was to provide the claimant with necessary information to allow her to terminate any pregnancy affected by haemophilia. However, in the Court of Appeal, Lady Justice Davis said, well, actually, you have to look at SAMCO, and summarise SAMCO as being a three-part test. One, what's the purpose of the procedure or information advice which is alleged to be negligent? Secondly, looking at that, what's the appropriate way to apportion risk between the parties? And thirdly, what losses would have in any event have occurred if the advice or information had been correct or the procedure had been performed? And emphasised that SAMCO says there has to be a link between the breach of duty and the particular type of cause claimed. The Court of Appeal said, well, the focus of this consultation was directed to the haemophilia issue and not the wider issue of whether, generally, she should become pregnant. It was not part of the consultation, still less was any advice sought that in the event the respondent did give birth, a child of hers could suffer from a condition such as autism. It was not within the scope of duty to protect the respondent from all the risks associated with being pregnant and continuing the pregnancy. It distinguished Chester, so this is the confining of Chester, by saying the misfortune in Chester is the very misfortune that there was a duty to warn against, whereas here, the autism is a coincidental injury. I think it is difficult, though, to see that the injury in Kahn is any more coincidental than actually what the injury in Chester was, and really it's a policy decision to try to confine it. Pomfrey, and this is a very recent decision, there was a delayed diagnosis of Cowder Aquina, and then there's a question of causation and complication from the surgery. The judge held that there'd been a negligent 10-day of delays, but the risk of the injury would have been the same on any occasion, assuming that there was no materially different circumstances. And he found that there would not have been, it was very unlikely to have been any material change or deterioration within those 10 days. So as a fact, the delay made no difference to the outcome. And but for the delay, the operation would have still been carried out, same surgeon, and the same dural tear will have occurred. So he said in respect to Chester that had in Chester the claimant succeeded on conventional causation, there would have been no need to extend the existing principles. But he said, well, I find no support in Chester to say that therefore there is any change to causation where the starting point, as it is in Pomfrey, is a breach of duty does not affect the risk which is inherent in the procedure. He also commented he thought that Crossman was wrong and noted that in Deuce, the Court of Appeal had re-emphasised the limitations of but-for causation. Another way that it has been confined is by saying there's a requirement to plead, and that was emphasised in Correa, saying you must explicitly plead Chester right up front at the beginning. But really the main way it's been confined has been to the facts. And in Correa, this was where there'd been a three-stage procedure, the final stage of which was negligently not performed. So she said, well, I haven't been warned about the material risks of having a three-stage procedure where I don't have the third stage. So therefore, I haven't given proper informed consent. And Lord Justice Simon said, well, the negligent failure in the third stage doesn't make it a different operation for the purposes of consent. It's a breach of duty which had the potential to give rise to liability for damages, but only if all the other elements of the tort of negligence were made out. The claimant had made an informed choice to have the surgery, and the injury was not intimately linked with the duty to warn. Just pausing there, comparing Chester as against Correa, it is quite hard to see how that injury is not intimately linked in the broader sense of how the claimant was informed about what the procedure would be. But going back to Lord Justice Simon, he said, the implications of a finding that a negligent act in the course of an operation vitiated consent would have potentially far-reaching consequences. There was therefore no breach of the defendant's duty in relation to the claimant's consent. And furthermore, it was a crucial finding in Chester against Ashford that if warned of the risk, the claimant would have deferred the operation. In Diamond, this is 8th of April, so a very recent case, Lady Justice Davis said that there was a spinal surgery where the appellant had a hernia requiring post-operative repair. The surgeon elected to use a mesh-based repair procedure, but did not ask the claimant if she intended to become pregnant in the future. Surgery 2011. 2014, the claimant goes to another surgeon and said that she was shocked and upset to find out that because of the mesh repair, that there would be a risk if she became pregnant. The claimant said, well, even if I can't win for my psychiatric injury on conventional principles, that I should win because my shock and distress and later depression was intimately connected with a failure to obtain consent. And Lady Justice Davis said that the judge determined, even if the appellant had been warned of the relevant risk, she would have still proceeded with the mesh repair. There is therefore no factual basis on which to argue sufficient connection. Finally, a contention that a failure to warn in 2011 is intimately connected with advice given in 2014 or 15 is also without any sound factual basis. Criticisms that have been made. In Michael John, an early Court of Appeal case, Lady Justice Rafferty said, at most, Chester is a modest acknowledgement of narrow facts far from analogous to those we are considering, which I think as judicial speakers, we don't want to go near it. In Deuce, Lord Justice Leggett said, this decision is highly problematic because in Chester, the claimant was not exposed to a risk to which she wouldn't otherwise have been exposed. And arguably, the defendant had no duty to protect the claimant from a risk of serious injury from a known but rare complication. And that the assumption the claimant had been prepared to accept the risk to which she was exposed was not based on any finding to that effect, but merely on her inability to prove otherwise. So is there any hope left out there for Chester? Well, interestingly, 12th of April, Mills against Oxford, Karen Stein, QC, held that there had been a lack of informed consent to neurosurgery, which resulted in a stroke because there was a failure to discuss alternatives. The claimant said, well, if I'd been told about one of these alternatives, then provided that the choice of technique made it more difficult to control the bleeding, which was the risk, then I would have had the very injury that was the focus of the duty of warn, and the causation was established. The trust said, look at Kahn, this complication's outside the scope of duty to warn. And Karen Stein said, well, the claimant would have chosen to have had microscopically assisted resection if he'd been given appropriate information. Such a technique would have reduced the risk of the bleeding, which led to a stroke, and this was the risk about which the claimant should have warned. Accordingly, this is a case where the misfortune to befall the claimant was the very misfortune which was the focus of the surgeon's duty to warn, and cited Ashford. So do we have a lottery? I think we do a bit. I think I've attempted to summarise now where I think we're at, but it isn't very clear. I think to succeed under conventional principles, you have to prove that the claimant would not have consented to the operational procedure if they'd had consent appropriately to the risk, and the risk to which they would have not consented to because of materialises causing injuries. So warning equals no operation. That case you're fine, you get home on conventional but four principles. But you still have to relate the damage to the risk to which she should have been consented, or he or she. Chester, you can get there, but I think really you need to have delay. And on a later date, on a balance of probabilities, that damage wouldn't have occurred. But again, the damage has to be within the scope of duty, and that's where the really difficult comes through. And it has to be explicitly pleaded. That's probably the easiest bit. And just a reminder that there's no separate head of loss for invasion of personal autonomy. But I think really it's clear that at some point Chester is going to go to the Supreme Court. It's been mentioned in the Court of Appeal on a number of occasions where parties have said, I reserve the right to go to the Supreme Court on this if you find against me. Funnily enough, the Court of Appeal has yet to find, as I'm aware, has yet to find for claimants who said that or defendant who said that. But I think at some point the Supreme Court is going to have to face up to it. Now, because it's a 3-2 majority decision, that may open the door to it being overturned. But it would have to be a 7-member, I'd like to be a 7-member Supreme Court, and someone's got to have a case which is going to end up there. And given all of the other difficulties at running informed consent cases or other scope of duty cases, I do slightly wonder who's going to have the appetite to actually take it on a case to the Supreme Court.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.